Sex, family secrets, and the Irish mother and baby homes.
And it wasn't until the more recent scandals following the discovery of nearly 800 babies and small children who had been buried in a septic tank on the grounds of a former mother and baby home in County Galway in Tuam. And this kind of public scandal around the homes, that I began to realise that the secrets weren't only my family secrets, that what I was looking at here, and part of the reason I felt such shame around it, in fact, was that this was a set of national secrets.
That's Claire Wills. We talk with her about her family memoir, Missing Persons, or My Grandmother's Secrets. It explores a social history of Irish perceptions of illegitimacy and legitimacy, and the personal impact of that history on her own family. Then we replay our interview from March of this year with Claire Coughlin about her mystery novel centering around a clandestine abortion clinic in Ireland in the 1960s. And we continue our series of poetry readings from Mosab Abu Toha's book, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to find extra content with links, book excerpts, transcripts, and extended interviews? In 2015, an unmarked mass grave of some 800 babies was uncovered in a disused septic tank in County Galway, Ireland. The discovery sparked international outrage and led the Irish government to establish the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes. These were institutions, mostly run by Catholic nuns, where unwed women were sent to deliver their babies. The commission investigated the lives and deaths of thousands of former residents of the institutions. Its final report, submitted in 2020, found that on average a child died every 2 weeks in the homes between 1925 and 1961, totaling some 9,000 children, a mortality rate far higher than the rest of the population. Abusive treatment of the mothers and children was rampant. The women were not allowed to have contact with their families or the outside world, and fathers who wanted to marry the women were turned away. When my guest Claire Wills was in her 20s, she discovered she had a cousin who'd been born in one of those institutions in 1950s Ireland, a cousin she'd never met. Cousin Mary grew up in a mother and baby home not far from the farm where Will spent happy childhood summers. Yet she was never told of her cousin Mary's existence. How could a whole family, a whole country, abandon unmarried mothers and their children, erasing them from history? Claire Wills sets out to answer this question in her deeply personal and historically insightful book, Missing Persons or My Grandmother's Secrets. Wills shares her journey of uncovering the family secrets surrounding Mary's birth. She also explores the broader national scandal of mother and baby homes, as well as the social and historical conditions that gave rise to them. Through a blend of memoir and historical analysis, Wills illuminates the complex social forces that shape perceptions of legitimacy in Ireland and the devastating impact of secrecy on countless lives. Claire Wills is an acclaimed author and historian whose work focuses on 20th century British and Irish cultural history and literature. She teaches at Cambridge University. Claire Wills, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
This book, Missing Persons or My Grandmother's Secrets, is a deeply personal exploration of your family's history centered around an illegitimate, in quotes, pregnancy, because I don't like that term, illegitimate, being myself the product of a union between two people who were not married. This happened in the 1950s, where a mother and her infant entered what was called mother and baby homes in Ireland. You call it a story of generation gone wrong, a mother not married and a child stifled. Tell us, why did you decide to unearth these family secrets?
Well, I had a child on my own, myself, when I was in my mid-20s. I was a student at the time, and I got pregnant and decided to go and ahead and have my child, who's now 35. And it was around that time, and I think because of that experience, that my aunt told me about a cousin who I never got to meet. She was 7 years older than me, born in 1955, but she had never been allowed to belong. I agree with you. The word illegitimacy, it is a horrible word, but there's something that it says, I think, about belonging and legitimacy that I think is important for us to think about. So there I was in my mid-20s, feeling that I was in the same situation as the woman who my uncle had got pregnant. I know very little about their relationship. I don't know how long they were lovers for or anything like that. And it was a tremendous shock. A shock not only for me, but for my cousins who also learned about it at the same time. And for a very long time, I felt, I'm going to use the word again, illegitimate in wanting to know more about my cousin. I was brought up in England. My mother, who was from a small farm in West Cork, born in 1930, left in 1948 when she was 18 to come and work in England to train to be a nurse like so many other Irish women, and like one of her sisters, in fact. So even though I had a very close relationship with Ireland and we went back every summer and close relationship with all my cousins and my grandmother, I didn't feel exactly legitimate or allowed to try to find out more about my cousin for a very long time, like sort of 30 years. I did try and find out anyway, but I felt awkward about it. And it wasn't until the more recent scandals around mother and baby homes, following the discovery in 2014, of nearly 800 babies and small children who had been, what is the right word to use? Let's say deposited, buried in a septic tank on the grounds of a former mother and baby home in County Galway in Tuam. And this kind of public scandal around the homes, that I began to realise that the secrets weren't only my family secrets, that what I was looking at here, and part of the reason I felt such shame around it, in fact, was that this was a set of national secrets. And so that's a very long, meandering answer to why I felt I wanted to write about this.
Yeah, your book really weaves together these two strands, the personal and the historical or systemic picture of this construction of birth legitimacy and illegitimacy, which is really fascinating. And I wonder if you could actually talk a bit more about what were the social forces that impacted this construction of illegitimacy, because they actually changed over time. This was new to me. I thought that Ireland, you know, had always been extremely traditional, and it just took a really, really long time for this to change. But in fact, you find the roots back in the famine, the Irish famine of the mid-1800s.
Yeah. So Patrick Kavanagh, the poet, is probably kind of a lodestar in this. You know, his poem, The Great Hunger, written in 1942, talks about a kind of sexual hunger and a kind of failure of the family, which he's clearly rooting in the Great Famine of the 1840s. And I did find that the more I looked at my own family's history, the more the story got rooted further and further back. So the book is constructed really out of talking to my mum over a period of, well, I suppose over my entire life, but piecing together stories that my mother told me and my grandmother told her. And one of the stories that my mother led me to was the fact that my grandmother also had not been married when she first got pregnant in 1920. And when I looked back at her background, she was born in 1891. This is all in very poor land in rural area of West Cork. When I look back at her birth in 1891, I have a suspicion, I can't prove it, that she herself was not the daughter of the people that she thought were her parents. She was born much, much later, and she had sisters of 18 and 19. And my guess is actually that she may well have been the daughter of one of those sisters. One of those people she thought were her sisters, let's get that right, who emigrated to the Boston area in, a few years later. And what I became really interested in was the way the informal mechanisms that families had in that post-famine period, 1860s, 70s, 80s, and certainly into the 90s, of dealing with extramarital sex. I mean, really, I think it's important for us to remember the problem here is not it's not firstly the children who are born out of wedlock, as it were, but the sex that leads to it. This is the stuff that has to be hidden. People clearly were having sex, and demographers get very puzzled by the it can't be the case, and it isn't the case that Irish families had less sex than other people. So why were there? What happened to these children? And the implication is that families found informal ways, such as a grandmother bringing up the daughter of one of their children as their own, or informal fostering out, sharing children between cousins and things like that. Which doesn't mean to say that the sex and the pregnancies weren't being kept secret. They were, but different methods were found in the pre-independence period to handle it. And one of them was a very common method of getting married 2 or 3 months in to discovering that you are pregnant. In the case of my grandmother, she was 6 months pregnant when she got married, and it must have been very clear to everybody in the locality when she gave birth 3 months later that she wasn't. If I was writing this down, I put this in inverted commas. She wasn't as respectable, in inverted commas, as she might present herself as. There's a complicated reason, I think, for the 6 month wait. But one of the things I became interested in was what happened after Irish independence in 1922 that led to a kind of what I call a bureaucratization of the secrecy around sex. Now, the Catholic Church had been a kind of supporter of the Irish rural population. It was where they turned for support in the period of under the British Empire. It was a form of authority that people could trust, where they could not trust that the Royal Irish Constabulary or the workhouses. These were institutions run by the British, but the Catholic Church was not run by the British. It was, run by your own, and quite literally your own, because, farmers' sons and daughters went into the church and, became priests and nuns. So I think there's an important thing that we miss if we don't think about the impact of that friendly authority suddenly being given real control in rural areas, and not just rural areas, but it's a rural area I was looking at. So in the 20s and 30s, and this gets stronger in the 40s and 50s, if you've got sex that needs to be covered up, a child that needs to be kind of hidden, or found another solution for, you use the mother and baby homes. And it makes sense to me that that would be a kind of new form of bureaucratized secret keeping, which I think in the end proved absolutely tragic, really, for the Irish family, because it split them off from the people that they had been informally living with before and put them in institutions. And later you got adoption and people got lost completely from the family.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Claire Wills about her book, Missing Persons, or My Grandmother's Secrets. And the conditions were horrific. I mean, as you point out, you know, the bodies of over 800 children were found tellingly in a septic tank. But that is just emblematic of the rampant abuse, lack of care of these children. I mean, how did they die? Why there was such a high mortality rate? Talk about the conditions in the mother and baby homes for children and their mothers.
Well, the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes, which was very controversial, the report that it produced in 2020 was extremely controversial, particularly for the way that it placed primary responsibility for what happened to women and children in mother and baby homes, not with the Catholic Church and the social services, but with, and I think I'm quoting here, the parents of the girls and the fathers of their children. I'll come back to that in a second, because I think there's something very important to be said around that. But in terms of the Commission of Investigation's exploration of the conditions, there the report is kind of extremely articulate. There was very little money around. The nuns didn't get paid. The money for upkeep of the buildings, particularly actually if you got sent to a county home rather than a dedicated mother and baby home where there were, you know, slightly better conditions. The food was terrible. And, you know, in the 40s, particularly in the 1940s, where economic conditions in general were extremely bad in Ireland during the period of Irish neutrality, where, you know, actually mortality rates rose in general in the population during that period. But they were extremely high in the mother and baby homes. And one of the principal causes in, you know, death records is marasmus, malnutrition. There are extremely disturbing accounts of medical examinations of the homes where, you know, the babies are covered in sores, infected buttocks because they're not being cleaned properly. You know, the laundry is being done, but the babies themselves are not being cared for. And I think, again, we have to come back to that question around legitimacy then. These were seen as illegitimate children, not being cared for by the families to whom they belonged, and also not being cared for in the institutions where they were living. In fact, just to come back to that question of responsibility, it just seemed to me, and this is one of the spurs to me writing the book, seemed to be just such an unhelpful statement to make, that it was the parents of the women and girls and the fathers of their children who were mainly responsible. Because what we want to know is why. What would cause a family to give up their child to that kind of institution? No, there's no explanation of that in the Commission of Investigation report. And I think, you know, it's a tricky question to ask, because there aren't any records where people explain, you know, they don't write down, you know, I decided to let my daughter go into a mother and baby home and never see my grandchild again because, you know, we're not going to find that documentation. But I think we need to be thinking about why. And one of the answers I came up with was that, you know, people trusted the Catholic Church. They felt that this was the right thing to do.
But you go deeper than that. Not only maybe did they trust the Catholic Church, but the connection that you make between this and land ownership, I think, is very interesting. The whole issue of legitimacy and illegitimacy really attests to the institution of the agrarian economy, of the owning of farmland.
I think that's key. I definitely don't think that the primary responsibility also should be placed with the nuns who ran the homes. There's something that happened in the late 19th century around land ownership that makes illegitimacy impossible to bear for families. And one of the kind of gifts to me, really, was realizing that when my grandmother was born in 1891, there was nothing to lose by her being brought up by her grandmother. In fact, being the person who kind of inherited the home, because there was no land, or there was only a tiny bit of land. And when she got pregnant in 1920, again, there was no land. She was a servant, a slightly larger farm. She lived in on another farm. And my grandfather, the person who married her and who is probably the father of the child with whom she was pregnant in 1920, was a labourer. Neither of them owned anything. And that is why they could get married and manage things informally. So, America is the problem here in a kind of complicated way, because by the time my uncle got a neighbour pregnant in 1955, my grandparents had inherited money from relatives who had gone to America in the 1890s, and they had bought a farm. It was a small farm, 30-acre farm, quite good land, but, it was a small subsistence-level farm, but it was what they had. And the idea that you could let that sort of go to an illegitimate or unmarried or the non-legitimate family, I think just became too hard to imagine.
In other words, having some stake in the land is what made them participate. I mean, after all, where does the word legitimate and illegitimate come from? It comes from the law.
Yeah, from legal ownership. Yeah. Legal ownership of the land made, it's not just an Irish thing. This is what the whole of the 19th century novel is about. And it isn't just a kind of working class or rural underclass level.
It's about participating in a legal system of land ownership, and I assume primogeniture is part of this. So I wonder if you could talk to that, but also, what was the system for people who were large landowners? Because after all, the same concerns would apply, but they had very different treatment.
Yeah, the legal ownership of land, I think, is crucial. And there's a quick shift in Ireland. The 1923 Land Act, I think, is crucial here. We think of the 1922 independence as central, but I think the 1923 Land Act, which gave many more small landowners ownership of the land rather than tenancy. If you're a large landowner and you have money to spend, you still don't want your daughter who's got pregnant or your son who's going to bring in somebody who you haven't decided you particularly want in your family, but you can afford to pay to be a private patient or a private client of one of the mother and baby homes. So the mother and baby homes catered for both private and kind of state or council women and their children. And if you were a private patient or client, you could pay £100 to leave your child in the home while you were able to leave. And if you were a council resident, you had to work. You had to sort of work off your keep. So, for example, many people will have seen the film Philomena, which is about a woman called Philomena Lee, who lived with her child for 3 years in a home, working off her keep. And then he was adopted. She didn't want him to be adopted, but she signed the forms not really knowing what they meant. If we go back to what we were talking about earlier about malnutrition and the death of babies, it is also the case that more babies born to private paying residents of the homes died because they were not looked after by their parents. They paid the nuns to look after them, and they didn't look after them well.
That's so interesting. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about secrets and secrecy, because Claire Wills, in this wonderful book, Missing Persons or My Grandmother's Secrets, this is also really important, you know, the dynamics of secrets and what they meant, how they influenced your relationships within the family and your relationship with your mother, who kept secrets until she didn't, and your own sense of complicity in keeping them and then revealing them. I just found that very interesting. So take us through that, those thoughts.
So I go back to when I'm 20 and I discover that there's this major secret that has been kept. And I tried to ask people about it. I tried to ask my mother and my aunt, who are the two people who would be able to tell me things. And they did tell me things, particularly my aunt, in fact. But for example, the secret about my grandmother being pregnant when she got married took many more decades to come out. And I think it's partly come out, you know, we all know, I don't know if this is more true of Irish mothers, but you know, mothers, I'm one myself, I like to half tell things. We kind of want something out there, but we don't quite want the responsibility for telling it. And I definitely felt that was happening with my mother, who's now 94 nearly, and very aware of the national secrets that have come to light recently around the mother and baby homes. And I think she's been carrying secrets that she doesn't quite want to tell, but she doesn't want to not tell either. And for me, that is a kind of central, tricky part of the book, because I am betraying family secrets. I can't pretend I'm not. I feel that I have been given the right to do so by my mother. And yet it's a complicated line to walk. On the one hand, for example, I would not feel that I did have the right to talk about my grandmother's rejection. I mean, it's a cruel, cruel bit of behavior on my grandmother's part, and certainly on my uncle's part. Rejection of a neighbor and rejection of her granddaughter. So I'm not telling particularly benign secrets. I'm telling nasty secrets about my relatives. And I had to feel in telling them that there was a larger point to it. I had to feel, you know, the central title to the book is, you know, Missing Persons. And part of my point in the book is that nearly every Irish family has these missing persons. 57,000 babies were born in mother and baby homes between 1922 and the 1990s. And that's the very lowest estimate. All of them had grandparents, four of them. And they all had mothers and fathers. And those mothers and fathers of those children had siblings and cousins. So every single person in Ireland and in the wide world, in Britain and in America, is affected by this keeping of secrets around missing people. People who are in the family but appear to be missing. And I feel really strongly that we will never come to terms with the history of these missing people unless we talk about it. So I had to make the decision that I was going to betray the secret, even though it's a betrayal.
And what's been the reaction from your own family?
That is interesting. So they have been very supportive. I want to make clear that I might be the writer in the family, but I'm not the only person who was shocked by this history shocked by discovering the story of my cousin. And we've, over the years, had many conversations, my sisters, cousins and I, about, and, you know, everybody knew that I was writing about it. And several of my family in West Cork read the book before it was published and were very supportive. I have to say that the way that it was reported in the Irish papers was a shock. It was a shock to me. And I was living in England. And I think I wish that I had handled that better. I hadn't anticipated that what to me were the important subtleties of why I was telling these secrets were going to just kind of fall out of notice or fall by the wayside in some of the newspaper coverage, which was, you know, pictures of my granny and the terrible things she did, basically. And that was extremely disappointing and very hard for my family who live in West Cork.
What would you have preferred the treatment to have been? What do you think the paper should have said?
Well, in the end, I started giving interviews and with, you know, people would start on the line of the newspapers. So tell us about your granny. What did she do? And I ended up saying in interviews, no, my granny is your granny. And people looked a bit puzzled, but at least they did get it. That this is, yes, it's missing persons and my grandmother's secrets, but it's also yours. You know, this is a book about how we all need to think about this history. And I think in the end, people got it in relation to my granny is your granny. And they also, I think, got my sense that responsibility, which has all these connotations of blame and guilt, is not the best way to think about this history. Because, you know, if we think in terms of who's responsible, you know, it's a kind of back and forth battle between, is it the families, is it the institutions? And I think it's not a helpful way to think about it. It's much more helpful to think in terms of a more general cultural answerability to this history. I am answerable to the things that happened in the 1950s, partly because I benefited. I mean, I also lost contact with my cousin, who I never knew. So that's one way in which I didn't benefit from the history. But in other ways, I benefited. There was quite literally more to go around. We were 12 cousins instead of 13. And I think people get also, when I say, look, I feel accountable, I feel answerable. But I also want people to make the next move, which is they are answerable too. And I think some, you know, that may be some time coming.
Well, it's a wonderful book and beautifully written, by the way. Missing Persons or My Grandmother's Secrets. And it's just been so interesting to talk with you, Claire Wills, about this book.
Lovely to talk to you.
Claire Wills, read or listen to an excerpt from Missing Persons by going to writersvoice.net. Stay tuned for more of Writer's Voice after the break. Waterfall by Chris Williamson. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like extended interviews and links. In our first segment today, we spoke with Claire Wills about her family memoir about the Irish mother and baby homes and their impact on her own family. Last March, we spoke with Claire Coughlin about her mystery novel, Where They Lie, whose plot centers around a clandestine abortion clinic in Ireland in the 1960s, a novel that examines some of the same territory as Claire Wills' book, but from another angle. Let's listen to that conversation now. Former investigative journalist Claire Coughlin always wanted to write crime fiction, and we are so glad she's finally been able to do so. Her debut novel is Where They Lie. It's 1968 Dublin, and Ireland is on the cusp. The stranglehold grip of the old order of the Catholic Church is just beginning to slacken. There are new opportunities for women in investigative journalism, for example. But contraception won't be available until 1985, and abortion until 2018. That's 50 years after Coughlin's protagonist, the young female journalist Nicoletta Sarto, takes on the task of investigating a case long gone cold, the death of a young woman that could be linked to a clandestine abortion clinic. A beautifully atmospheric thriller, Where They Lie uses a murder mystery as a lens to focus on the long struggle of women fighting to achieve autonomy in Ireland's man's world. Claire Coughlin, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me, Francesca.
Now, this is just a terrific debut novel, but you are not a newcomer to writing. You've worked as a journalist for the last 18 years, and your protagonist, Nicoletta Sarto, is also a journalist. So tell us a little bit about why you made this jump from journalism, although I assume you haven't left journalism, to mystery writing.
First of all, thank you so much for your kind words about my novel. It was a long time in the making. I think I always wanted to write fiction, but when I left university, I studied English and Italian at University College Dublin, and I always wanted to write fiction, but I didn't know how to go about doing it. So I thought journalism would be a good stepping stone into writing. I didn't really know that much at the time. I just thought I wanted to write, and that was the only feasible way of going about it. I didn't really know anyone who'd become a novelist, although Cecilia Hearn, who's been very successful since a young age, I think she was 21 when her first novel was published, broke the mold for Irish female writers in a commercial sense. But yeah, I was coming at it from a sense of when I had been a journalist for about 5 years, I decided to do an MA in creative writing in UCD. And I then decided that I really wanted to write about a journalist, but I just didn't know when or how.
Well, it's a terrific choice because this is an investigative journalist. I think it's the other profession that's great for being featured in mystery writing. You know, there's detectives.
Yes. But yeah. The journalist as detective is something I loved writing about. And I particularly enjoyed writing about 1968 because there was none of the technology that we take for granted now. There was no Google search or WhatsApp message to alert Nicoletta to anything that might have been occurring. So all of her knowledge that she accumulated had to be achieved by the old-fashioned way of walking around Dublin talking to people. And I really enjoyed that slower pace, I think, of not the instant gratification we're used to now in terms of information, you know.
Yeah, and also you have such vivid descriptions of Ireland at that time. Before we get into the meat of this great story, you know, talk a little bit about the process of bringing 1968 to life.
Okay, well, I went to the National Library in Dublin and read some of the contemporaneous newspapers from the time. I also read a book called Maeve's Times, which was a compendium of journalism by the late novelist Maeve Binchy. And she was actually the first women's pages editor of the Irish Times newspaper. And in her collection of journalism is like her novels. It's fierce, uncompromising, with a great sense of humor. And a lot of the issues she covered are still prescient today, such as abortion rights, contraception, a woman's place in the workplace and in the home. And I knew once I'd read this collection of journalism that I wanted to set my journalist character at a time that was changing, but also at a time that was kind of static in Ireland, because Ireland was still very much, emigration was very high and women's place in society was very defined by a domestic role. And I decided that that's exactly when I wanted to set it.
Yeah, and you know, I was really thinking a lot about Tana French as I read this novel, Where They Lie. Claire Coughlin, she wrote the blurb that's on the front cover, and she also examines social issues through the medium of mystery fiction. Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think essentially all novels have a mystery at their heart, but I just love crime fiction as a medium to make it bigger and better brush strokes, if you want to call it that. And I was so happy when Tana gave me that quote. I mean, I've been a big fan of hers since 2007, 2008, when her first novel came out. And I actually interviewed her for an Irish newspaper at the time that her first novel came out. And I've read every single one since. And she was a big inspiration in terms of, I knew I wanted to write about Dublin, and I knew I wanted to examine the social issues behind the themes that I was writing about.
Mm. Yeah, she's been on the show at least two times, maybe more.
Yeah.
She's great. So now, tell us more about the story. We know that it features a journalist and crime.
Yeah.
It takes place when the body of an actress who disappeared 25 years earlier is found. So introduce us to the story. Tell us about the young journalist who investigates that crime and that disappearance, Nicoletta Sarto.
So Nicoletta is in the newsroom on Christmas Eve when a call comes through saying that a woman's skeleton has been found in a seaside garden. And it's been positively identified as Julia Bridges, an actress who disappeared in 1943. And Nicoletta knows that she wants to make, she's young, driven, very ambitious. She's conflicted and she wants to make a name for herself. So she decides to undertake this story and see where it takes her. And it leads her into a kind of web of, she uncovers all the hypocrisies and lies that she's encountered all her life and unravels them. And I suppose you could say the truth comes at a price for Nicoletta. And
yeah, so the story involves an ex-midwife, Gloria Fitzpatrick, who also is not alive when the story begins. She lost her license after performing a botched abortion. And as you mentioned before, this book examines the position of women in Ireland, actually from several different angles, discrimination in the workplace and lack of reproductive freedom. And it was only recently, in 2018, that abortion was legalized in Ireland. So talk about what it was like to be a woman in 1968 and before in your country.
Mm-hmm. I think there was a climate of fear. There was a climate of secrecy. And a culture of, I suppose, hypocrisy, because everyone knew, yet everyone pretended not to know. And it was very much a woman's problem. If an unwanted pregnancy occurred, contraception was illegal. And up until recently, if you wanted to have an abortion, you had to go to the UK. And there was still very much a culture of secrecy and shame attached to that particular journey.
And what was it like to be a journalist as a woman in that time?
I think it was more difficult than anything that I ever experienced as a journalist. I think the constant need to prove oneself was ever present. And I think there might have been a sense as well that you didn't belong.
Were there many women who were in journalism and still had to fight, or was it beginning to change at that time?
It was definitely beginning to change at that time. And the Irish Women's Liberation Movement was founded in 1970, and that was made up of many women journalists, and they staged a train journey to Belfast to buy condoms and brought them back and were photographed bringing them back over into Connolly Station in Dublin to make a point that it was a woman's choice, like that women deserved reproductive choices. And so times were changing, but I think the particular time I wrote about in 1968, things were kind of on the cusp.
They were on the cusp, and yet it took until 2018 to actually legalize abortion. of course, in this country, we had a reproductive rights for 50 years and they've just been taken away. So there's no judgment there. But I just wonder, do you have any opinion on as to why it took so long?
I think attitudes took a long time to change. And Ireland is a very multicultural, cosmopolitan country now. But it took a while, I suppose, for economic reasons as well. Like, they say that the swinging 60s didn't happen in Ireland until the economic boom of the Celtic Tiger, which was the 1990s. You know, like, same-sex marriage was legalized in Ireland in 2015 as well. So we have come a long way. But I think it just took that long for the attitudes of especially the church and state were so entwined as well, the Catholic Church.
Yeah. So, and we are talking with Claire Coughlin about her novel, her crime fiction novel, Where They Lie. Now, you know, it struck me that the other reporters at the paper's called The Sentinel, are for the most part supportive of Nicoletta. I was a little surprised at that because I thought, well, there would have been a lot of kind of backbiting or resentment. But no. They're pretty supportive. Do you want to say why you made that choice? And is that what you've experienced?
Yeah, Nicoletta's colleagues are supportive of her for the most part. It's just kind of structural inequalities that stand in her way. Like, on paper, her male colleagues don't have much of a problem with her, apart from the fact that she's in a relationship with her boss. But for things like, for example, in the sequel that I'm writing at the moment, she's just returned from maternity leave, but it's a very short maternity leave. And she feels that if she doesn't go back quickly, she'll lose her position.
Well, I can't wait to read that because this was really terrific read. I mean, lots of twisty turns, which I'm going to ask you a little bit about later. But, you know, with a mystery like this one, we really can't give anything away about the plot that would spoil the suspense. But you did mention before that it came at a personal cost. The investigation comes at a personal cost for Nicoletta Sarto. Why did you choose to make the protagonist become so basically deeply involved in what she was investigating?
Yeah, I was just really interested in the point that Nicoletta is at in her life. She's trying desperately to move away from her past, but she's at a major turning point. And I think it's something that Tana French's Dublin Murder Squad novels do so well, is the detective always gets personally involved or has a personal connection with the case. And I've thought that was a really interesting approach in terms of the high stakes for the novel, for the protagonist. And funnily enough, in the second book that I'm writing, it's not as personal to Nicoletta, because you can't have that many skeletons in one's closet, but her personal life does get in the way.
So, as I said, you have a truly twisty plot with lots of surprises. Can you give us a window into your process of crafting the plot points?
Yeah, I always start with the character and setting. And I walk a lot and I make copious notes on the notes app on my phone, kind of telling myself the story when something occurs to me. And then I go home and on my laptop, do a story arc, like draw out a story arc. And I'm a big fan of a lot of screenwriting books that have really helped me with plotting. So I try and, you know, do the three-act structure.
The what?
A three-act structure.
Three-act.
Like, yeah. And I recently read a book called Stealing Hollywood by Alexandra Solikoff. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. And she follows the three-act structure, but she approaches planning a novel like a screenwriter and planning eight sequences and making it as visual for yourself as possible, so that it feels like each sequence is working, doing its thing at a different point in the story.
Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I have an idea in my mind for what should happen within those eight sequences. And I write out, like just in a Word document, a very brief description. so that I have an idea of, and I, at the moment, I might know exactly what's going on in the middle, but I have an idea of the very clear idea of the beginning and end sequences, so that I have an idea of my end destination. Might not know exactly how I'll get there, but it's good to have an end point in sight, I think.
So did you know the end before you started, you know, really writing this book?
Yes, I did, yeah. I had an idea of the end sequence and that someone else was going to get killed. That's not a spoiler, I don't think. Yeah, I actually wrote the last scene pretty early on. So yeah, endings are very important to me, I think. I love, as a reader, I love a really satisfying ending.
And this one was. Yeah, I like a satisfying ending too. And
thank you.
And this one was great. So I want to come back to Ireland in the real life, not fiction, and ask you, how have things changed in Ireland since abortion became legal?
They have changed enormously in the last, well, Ireland has changed as a society enormously in the last kind of 30 years. It's not as conservative a society as it was. People don't listen to the church as much as they did. The idea of a family and what that constitutes has changed in accordance with the times. We're not a monocultural society anymore. And there's been a lot of immigration to Ireland as a result of the economic boom of the late 90s to late 2000s. But I think the referendum around abortion in 2018 opened a conversation that needed to be had for a long time around pregnancy, miscarriage, unwanted pregnancies, just on around the whole reproductive spectrum. And I think we're more open about those issues now than we would have been before.
Is there any danger of a backlash, or what has happened like here in the US?
I don't think so at the moment. I haven't heard in a while that there have been protests at hospital, at maternity hospitals or anything like that. Yeah, I don't think there has been a backlash.
And your protagonist, Nicoleta Sarto, we can tell by her name that it's not a traditional Irish name.
That's right, yeah.
Was there a reason that you made her, were her parents immigrants, is that right?
Yeah, so her parents, there's quite a, I suppose in the early to mid 20th century, there was a wave of immigration from a town called Casalatico near Rome to Ireland and also the UK. And I suppose Nicoleta's parents would have been part of that wave of immigrants. And most of them settled in Dublin and elsewhere in the country and started businesses in hospitality. And I made Nicoleta's parents shopkeepers. And I think the reason I did that was because I've always felt an affinity with the Italian language and culture. And when I read a book about Italian immigration to Ireland, and I just captured my imagination a little bit. I wanted Nicoleta to feel like an outsider a little bit.
Yeah. Now, you've told us already you're starting, or I don't know how long you're into it, but writing the sequel to this. Do you think you can be a journalist and a fiction writer at the same time?
No, I don't think so. I haven't done any journalism in about a year. I'm focusing on the fiction at the moment. So I know a few, like some broadcasters who manage to juggle both, but I'm not very good at multitasking. So I think I prefer to focus on the fiction at the moment.
Well, I think it's a treat for readers, at least on this side of the pond. Claire Coughlin, you are the author of the crime fiction novel, Where They Lie. It is absolutely terrific. I highly recommend it to my listeners. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thanks so much, Francesca. It was great to talk to you.
Claire Coughlin talking with us in March of this year about her book, Where They Lie. With no end in sight of the slaughter of innocent civilians in Gaza by Israel and the continued captivity of Israeli hostages by Hamas, we continue our series of reading poetry by Palestinian poet Mousab Abu Toha. We read from his book, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza. Here's part of the long poem, The Wounds, which gives some of the backstory of today's conflict, the long history of Israeli assaults on Gaza. The Wounds, Israeli Aggression Against Gaza, December 27, 2008, to January 18, 2009. A Saturday, first day of the week in Gaza. Age 16, and after the first finals, I finished my Arabic exam. I liked Arabic as much as I liked English and soccer. I discussed my answers with my father. Home by noon, we stood on the roof of our house, watched the pigeons my father raised as a hobby. The limitless ceiling above us was part blue, part white, ships of clouds sailing slowly in windless sky. A series of explosions shook the house, the neighborhood, shook the earth. Words fell from my mouth, broke on my stiff, bare feet. Birds from nowhere flew aimlessly in the open sky. Some hidden trees. The pigeons in their big coop trembled. Rock pigeons, Egyptian pigeons, king pigeons, and Halabi pigeons. A tiny egg fell. My answers must have fallen off the pages of my exam, maybe melting from fear. I saw black smoke rise from a building a few kilometers away, blacker than the ink on my exam sheets. We didn't hear the F-16s until they finished their strikes. They descended from the inferno. Dante hadn't mentioned them. About 80 F-16 aircraft with their bombs struck Gaza in unison, like a big drum roll announcing someone's death. But it was more than one death, I thought. It had to be. We hurried to the radio, that old dirty box that usually vomits blood and body parts into our ears, hospitals full of burning wounds, moans, a corpse, and a girl missing her leg, lying on a cot or a bloody floor. Over 200 policemen killed and 700 wounded in that dark hour. They had been training in police training facilities. And 2 million other people worried for their lives. Don't think of us as numbers. That was part of the poem The Wounds by Mosab Abu Toha from his book Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.